Coming up on this week's book show, Imaginary Friend is the new novel, a horror story by Stephen Chbosky. It comes 20 years after he wrote the best-selling coming-of-age novel, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. The new book raises questions about faith, parenting, friendship, and what it means to protect those you love most in an increasingly complex and dangerous world. Stephen Chbosky on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Imaginary Friend is the new novel, a horror story, by Stephen Chbosky. It comes 20 years after he wrote the best-selling coming-of-age novel, The Perks of Being a Wallflower. In the meantime, he has also directed films, including Wonder and the TV series Jericho. Imaginary Friend is an epic work of literary horror that raises questions about faith, parenting, friendship, and what it means to protect those you love most in an increasingly complex and dangerous world. It is a chilling tale of a haunted young boy named Christopher. After vanishing in the woods for 6 days, the child emerges with a voice in his head only he can hear and a mission he must complete. Stephen Chbosky's new novel is Imaginary Friend, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Joe. This is fantastic.
So it has been 20 years since your last book, Perks of Being a Wallflower, and my understanding is this novel has been in the works on and off for about 10 years. Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. I thought of the idea maybe 15, 16 years ago, but then when I was doing the movie adaptation that I directed at Perks, I fell in love with books all over again, and I knew I had to do it. I knew I had to write another one. So yeah, it's been about 10 years off and on when I wasn't doing other things.
Do you see this, because on the face of it, I thought, well, this is nothing like Perks of Being a Wallflower. And then as you read it, you do see very, very similar themes. And I'm curious for you as an author, was it something completely different, or did you feel that you were in a comfortable wheelhouse?
Well, I felt very comfortable as a fan. See, a lot of the themes, the characters, the way that I approach, you know, stories with heart, that is very, very similar to Perks. And Perks came from my love of the coming-of-age novel, and I love many of them. And Imaginary Friend came from my love of horror, in particular Stephen King. So to me, it felt very comfortable. It was like, I have my own stories to tell. I have my own past, things that interest me. Things that I'm always going to investigate, and different genres have slightly different rules. And if you're a fan of those, I find it very comfortable to tell stories in different genres.
When it came to the start of this book, did you know that you wanted to write horror? You knew that you wanted to tell a story that was, for want of a better term, spooky?
Yeah, 100%. You know, my feeling was, there are all these things, especially from childhood, that I remember, dreams that I had where my teacher attacked me and other things that I just, those images and those feelings, they never left. And I wrote this book in a lot of ways to kind of exorcise those demons, you know, all the way down to like a moment where, you know, Christopher, the little boy, the hero of the story, right, that, you know, he's watching his Saturday morning cartoons the way that I did, the way that so many of us did. And I always thought, you know, what would happen if, you know, he's watching this show, Bad Cat. I invented the show, and he's watching Bad Cat, and suddenly the cartoon stops and turns to the screen and says, "Oh, hi, Christopher. You enjoying the show?" And I thought, okay, that's kind of scary. And all the way down to when you're a little kid and you're laying in the grass and you look up in the clouds and you say, oh, it looks like a hammer, a dog, a face. And I thought, well, what if the cloud that you noticed for the last 2 weeks was always the same face looking back at you? What does that mean? And what would happen if you converse with the cloud and you followed that cloud into the woods, and where would it lead?
It is interesting to me, you mentioned that Bad Cat scene, because that snuck up on me. There's several moments in the book that are scary before that, but then that comes and it seems like, oh wow, that's the coolest thing in the world. And then you realize that it has this horrific moment to it of having this character that you have established, Bad Cat, as something that Christopher just is, because he's a little boy. You almost have to keep reminding yourself through reading the novel that Christopher is only, what, 7 years old?
Yeah, he's 7.5 years old. And then over time, you know, after he emerges from the woods, after he goes missing, the fact that suddenly this struggling student becomes a wonderful reader and good at math, and almost like an empath, he knows what people are feeling on one level. And just like Perks Being a Wallflower, Charlie, through his sensitivity, understood what was going on around him. In this case, with Christopher, I added that little extra piece. I'm really interested in characters who see or feel things that maybe other people cannot see or feel.
And he even develops a telepathic sense, right? I mean, I think you call it flashcards, where he'll look at a character and say, well, you are thinking that your husband was out late last night and does not love you anymore.
Yes, I again, there are so many things, the way that children perceive the world, and they notice things very often, even before they can speak, they can feel attention or they can feel it in a nonverbal way. And they're very, very perceptive. And I just wanted to give that truth a little extra boost with this story. I was very interested in what would happen if a child who had so many difficult times was given a genuine power.
We'll just talk about just the setup of the novel. So Christopher, of course, is the son of Kate Reese. And at the beginning of the novel, they're basically on the run, and they wind up in western Pennsylvania. So with that background, give us a sense of where these characters were and how they integrate themselves into this community.
Well, where they were is you know, and I'm not spoiling anything because it's pretty early on in the book, but to make a long story short, Kate Reese, her husband, Christopher's father, he had a lot of mental problems and he committed suicide. And this is backstory. After that happened, you know, Kate did everything she could to protect her son, but she was almost out of body for a few years. And when she comes to the little town of Millgrove, Pennsylvania, she just escaped a very abusive or a relationship that was about to turn very abusive. And she just said to herself, no more. And even though she, you know, she doesn't have a college education, she doesn't have a lot of advantages. She loves her son, and she's going to do everything in her power to give him a better life in this place. And so that's what she does. And a lot of the story is about Kate and Christopher, how they love each other, how they support each other, how they challenge each other at times, and how they're the two most unlikely soldiers to be on the front line of a struggle between good and evil, but they are great soldiers in the cause of good.
Mm. It's always, in reading the novel, I thought it was beautiful of just how much they know about each other.
Well, I'm glad that you feel that way. You know, one of the things, this is going back to The Perks of Being a Wallflower, one of the reasons why I did that movie in particular, the book for sure, but the movie, was that I really genuinely believe that a generation gap is nothing but a conversation we haven't had yet. And when I made the movie Wonder, I wanted to make a movie that grandparents would love as much as children, as much as their parents, because how nice would it be if three generations sat in a room together and they all cared, or they all laughed at the same thing, or they all cried at the same thing? Yes, I know the books are a more isolated experience, but the same feeling exists. That's why also Imaginary Friend not only does it have children characters and teen characters and adult characters, it also has older people as well. I like writing foul-mouthed old people. It's very fun.
The fun, you know, of writing foul-mouthed old people.
Yes, but ones that you think, because I remember as a little boy, and again, going back to the perceptions of children, we all remember the older person that kind of told you like it was, you know, because kids know authenticity versus like,
right.
They feel it, you know, the people that are being, and I remember there was this one lady, she was my mom's aunt, and she was a nun, God rest her soul. And this is many years ago, and we were at Cousin Paul's wedding. And she sat there, and there's this whole big tower of plastic, like champagne flutes. And she looked at all of his kids, and she said, watch this. And they were empty, and she swung her arm and threw them all over the floor. And we laughed so hard. She's like, I can do that because I'm a nun. And I just thought, I will never. I loved her so much. I love that moment.
Stephen Chbosky is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is Imaginary Friend. It is published by Grand Central. Speaking of nuns, talk a little bit about the spiritual component to this novel.
This novel, I know that it's, you know, it's in the horror genre, but it is fiercely personal to me. It's very emotional to me, the book. And a lot of it came directly from my childhood. I was raised Catholic, and I was fascinated by the way that children are taught things. You know, if you notice, like in the style of the book, there's a lot of repetition, and that's deliberate. There's repetition because that is how we learn fairy tales. There's a lot of allusions to Grimm as well, and classic fairy tales, like, you know, when he goes into the woods, he's wearing a red hoodie. You know, it's a fairly obvious Little Red Riding Hood comparison, but those are there in the spiritual side as well, because from a sense of this idea of, okay, if you're in church or wherever you are in your car, even if you're at home and you pray, are you praying to God or are you talking to yourself? And that is a question. And by the way, I know what I feel, but I pose it that way. Just like the thing that Kate Reese's late husband says right before he dies, he says, you know, Kate, what are the two types of people who see things that aren't there? Visionaries and psychopaths. And I love this idea of not knowing what's, you know, is the negative voice inside your head. Is that you? Is that something from your past or is it something otherworldly? And so going back to faith for a second, this, I don't know, just growing up Catholic, so many of those images, so many of those things that I learned, what I felt about communion and all these other things, it just stuck with me. You know, I almost feel like I really understand why James Joyce kept writing about Dublin, because once it's a part of you, it's always a part of you. And growing up back then and knowing that I will always identify as Catholic because of my upbringing and I wanted to write it. You know, it's funny how all of my Catholic friends have read the book. They call me at the end and they go, wow. Wow, you were paying attention a lot more than we thought you were. I was like, yeah, I really was, you know. So I'm glad that you caught that part, that allusion in the book. It's really it means a lot to me that you did.
One of the things that also plays, and it probably took me a couple of times of you mentioning it before I jotted it down as looking for it as a theme, but Blue Moon, the song and that and just those words, Blue Moon, appear quite a bit in the novel.
Yeah, you know, that Blue Moon was partly an allusion to American Werewolf in London and the idea of, again, taking a classic image of a horror story. When in this case, it's a werewolf. Not that there's anything to do with werewolves and Imaginary Friend, but I like taking images that we have grown accustomed to and then just tweaking them just slightly to ask her, like, why we keep coming back to this? What is it about this? And how does it evoke? You know, there's a lot of moon imagery. There's a lot of, as you know, because you've read the book, a lot of imagery about the stars, you know, and the idea of what is a star and what does that light mean? And what happened if they all seem to burn out at once? I don't know. It's very profound to me. So I'm glad that you caught the Blue Moon illusion.
You write in the novel, help him, Kate, he's in trouble. As she listened to the horrible Muzak version of Blue Moon, she remembered something her husband told her right after he came out of one of his worst spells. What are the two types of people who can see things that aren't there, Kate? In his quiet whisper of a punchline, visionaries and psychopaths. That gets back to what we were talking about earlier about these two characters, the mother and son, knowing so much about each other and her deep concern about her son because she knows what's going on isn't right or normal.
Yes. Well, I wanted to write this story as if it were taking place in the real world. That was really interesting to me. And so if you see your son and your son is talking to a white plastic bag as if the white plastic bag were talking back to him.
Right.
What would you think of it?
Yeah.
And is there something actually in there? Is there a genuine voice that he can hear? Or is he mentally ill? Or is he insane? Does he have bipolar disorder? Is he schizophrenic? And so her faith is tested greatly. And all of her fears about her husband and a lot of fears that I know that parents have for their children, maybe not with mental illness necessarily, but with any kind of illness. You know, we want what's best for our kids at all costs. And so, you know, I remember, God, it's so funny, when my daughter Macy was born a little over 7 years ago, and Laurie Hall Sanderson, who wrote the book Speak, right around the time I talked to her, and she said, oh, yeah, my daughter was born. She's like, you know, the world just became a very scary place, didn't it? I said, oh, my God, yes, it did. I never even thought about it. There it was. And I thought, yeah, every parent can relate to that now. It's like suddenly there is something in the world that wasn't there before that I care above all others. And it's very, very powerful force.
One of the things that struck me, too, is that you talk about wanting to write in the real world. And the time when you go into this imaginary place, it's beautifully segmented the way you write about it, because we can envision that character on one side almost of the screen. This has a cinematic element to it of on one side of the screen, and then the other side there are characters, and in some cases Christopher himself looking at himself and saying, okay, there I am, I'm here in the real world, and this is the imaginary world, or is it the reverse?
Well, I feel that it could almost be either. I mean, the entire book poses the question, how much of this is happening inside of his mind and how much of this is true? You know, I'll always err on the side of true, but enough people have really scrutinized how I laid it out. And I did it deliberately because I want people to form their own conclusions. Ultimately, I believe that all art, you know, if you're doing it with intention, I know I always want the reader or the viewer, if I'm making a movie, to leave the theater or put down the book having finished it and feel empowered to answer their own question or to make their own choice to make their life better. And so it all comes back to that for me.
You partially answered this, but I'm curious as to whether it was a challenge at all to sustain this headspace of being in that world and thinking of the imaginary, thinking of the real, thinking of the clouds and a monster under the bed, of staying with that for as long as it was with you in the writing of the novel.
It was very challenging because the book was very ambitious and the things that I was trying to talk about were ambitious. But just like with all big ideas, you have to make them feel small or else it just becomes too lofty. And I wasn't interested in that. Like these themes, these questions that I have, almost existential questions at times, they mean a great deal to me personally, but I wanted to read like a thriller. I wanted it to be a page turner. Almost, you know, I remember talking about when I was making The Perks of Being a Wallflower movie, that all the deeper or the more sobering or more emotional components of the story, I wanted to almost sneak up on the viewer. Up until that moment, I wanted it to be mostly fun. So I was going to Trojan horse the message, as it were, or Trojan horse some of the emotion. I was doing the same thing with Imaginary Friend, you know, and so it was difficult to sustain, but I worked for years on it. It was always helpful, the fact that I would, say, work on the book for 6 months, and then I would go and direct Perks, and then I would come back and I worked on it for 9 months, and then I would go and write Beauty and the Beast, and then a year goes by, and then I'm doing Wonder. And so all those breaks helped me look at it with very fresh eyes and be very, very disciplined, even though it's a long book, to make sure that it felt tight. I wasn't interested in just filling pages to fill pages. I wanted it to be an ambitious story told right.
In the acknowledgments at the very beginning, you say, and finally, Emma Watson, who inspired the ending on The Perks of Being a Wallflower set, and Stephen King, who inspired everything else. So let us talk about Stephen King first, because that is what this book immediately reminded me of, was with those classic 70s and 80s Stephen King novels, these big, sprawling, scary tomes.
As I said, I love the genre, and he's been my favorite writer for as long as I knew there was such a thing that you could have a favorite writer. And when I was a young person, and I knew I wanted to be a writer, it was The Shining, and it was, you know, Misery and The Stand and all of his stories that just made me, that inspired me to do this. And so it was very easy for me to acknowledge, and, you know, and I'd never met him. I was very moved when his son, Joe Hill, gave me a lovely quote, you know, because I love his writing as well. I think The Fireman's a fantastic novel. So, yes, Stephen King, he's my hero. He's my literary hero. And I think that you cannot overstate how important he is to American letters. And how he hasn't won the Nobel Prize for Literature is beyond me. Like, I know that there's a certain level of right. what people think is appropriate for such an accolade, but I can't think of a more influential writer over the last 50 years than him. I can't.
I completely agree with you. But do you think it's because of with commercial success comes some diminutive force that says, okay, this isn't as important as perhaps it is?
Perhaps. You know, maybe it's the fact that, you know, if you can do it 60 times,
right?
Maybe if he had kept it at like 12 or 15, it would seem more, I don't know, mysterious or something. But he's such an accessible person in terms of, you know, offering praise for other writers and his tweets and everything else. You know, he's such a force out there. Maybe it's, I don't know. But then again, you know, ultimately, considering he's a living legend to all of us, you know, I highly doubt that he's sitting at home going, why don't I have more? I would hope at this point that he is aware of what he's given all of us, not only as readers, but just as writers.
I hope so. You know, you look at writers, though, like Vonnegut and Philip Roth, who at the end of their life felt like they had done enough. You know, that they didn't really, that it seemed like they were done. You hope that doesn't happen to someone, but you can see how it can when you have that kind of attraction and people, the work resonates with people so fully.
Yeah. But I hear you, but I also feel that ultimately the story is always the star, and it will always be the star. And the only reason that we know his name is because he's written so many stories that we love. You know, I remember working on Beauty and the Beast, the screenplay, and just thinking what an honor it was to be working. I was like, this story is perfect. Everything about it, what it's about, you know, its themes, they will make Beauty and the Beast versions. They'll be probably five a century, you know, for as long as there are movies, as long as there's musicals, as long as there's, you know, ways to do it. That's what matters. You know, The Haunted Hotel and The Shining, that endures. And so, you know, or you mentioned some of these other authors, like I would hope that Portnoy's Complaint, you know, continues forever because it's so funny.
Right.
And, you know, I think for anybody that works in an artistic field, all you hope is that you contribute at least one. If you can have just one that has an impression on readers or viewers forever, it's like you've done your job. And everything after that is gravy.
Were you surprised? I mean, we could say that about your first novel. I mean, you did that pretty much out of the box.
Well, you're very kind to say it. You know, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, it's interesting. Going back to when I was a kid, so I always wanted to be a novelist. That's what I wanted to do. And I remember saying to my father when I was 12 years old, like, Dad, I want to be a writer. That's why I said writer, not novelist. And he said, well, great writers are great readers. And then he kind of left the room to go smoke a Marlboro Red and watch the hockey game. and I took – it was actually great advice, but I didn't take it as advice. I took it as a statement of fact told to me by my hero, frozen in time. You know, what he was really trying to say is, hey, why don't you read more? But I didn't take it that way. I said, well – he knows I don't really read a lot other than Stephen King, but I watch movies. I guess I read movies. All right, I'll write movies. That is literally how I came to this strange career path of being a born novelist who spent his almost entire professional life making films. Because of that, my point of view on The Perks of Being a Wallflower book was when I wrote it, and little by little, bit by bit, as it kept selling over, you know, at this stage, two decades, you know, every week it was almost like a couple thousand copies, like a metronome. And then when I made the movie, it became a number one New York Times bestseller, which was really, really a dream come true for me. I just always thought of it not as a fluke necessarily, but, you know, I identified as a quote unquote movie guy. And then when I made the Perks movie and I was like, I want to do this again. And that's what Imaginary Friend was. And now that I've done it, trust me, it won't be 20 years till my next book. I am so in love with writing prose again. I've had just such a great time. So your compliment is very sweet about Perks. You know, I'm very grateful for the success it's enjoyed. And to me, it's a contract with the reader. It's like that if a book comes out and I wrote it, that it's the best I have at that day.
Okay, so we're running out of time, but I have two fanboy questions for you.
Okay, please.
One is the rumor true that John Hughes took the first crack at writing the screenplay for Perks?
No, I've seen that that rumor as well. I think it's on Wikipedia. I have no idea where it came from. First of all, he's the only human being I probably would have said, sure, give it a shot, you know, because The Breakfast Club is one of my favorite movies of all time. my God, the influence on The Breakfast Club on all of us. I mean, I'm talking everybody that followed that movie. It was such a cultural milestone in America. And so, yeah. So the answer is no, sadly.
Second question is, is the next big project Dear Evan Hansen?
Well, you know, Hollywood being Hollywood, we don't have like what is known as an official green light. However, it's looking really good, and I really deeply hope to be on set filming Dear Evan Hansen sometime in the middle of 2020.
So when you get signed up for that, was that out of an interest of you even agreeing to get as far as you've gotten now, of what came out of the Beauty and Beast experience of working with musicals?
I've loved musicals since I was in Fiddler on the Roof my junior year. And I only did...
What character did you play?
Oh, I was in the chorus.
Okay, all right.
I didn't even make it to the Russian bottle dance. I tried. I tried really hard. Yeah, I was in the back there singing about Anna Tevka. You know what I mean? It's just like, wow.
Yep.
You know, but I loved it. I loved it. And then I was Mr. Bundles and Annie. Perhaps you saw me. I was fantastic my senior year. I was the laundry man. Anyway, so I've always loved musicals. You know, when I did the screenplay for Rent, that was my first foray. Then I did this show called Kept that didn't really make it out of Palo Alto, but I worked with Henry Krieger and Bill Russell, and Scott Schwartz, all of whom are terrific Broadway talents, and then Beauty and the Beast. So I've done enough musicals that I really deeply wanted to try my hand at directing one, and this is my shot, and I'm very excited. The show is beautiful if you haven't seen it. You know, I recommend the soundtrack for everybody, and Ben Platt is such an incredible, incredible young performer. I'm so excited to work with him.
Yeah, and now he has said that he would, assuming it all goes, he'll be the guy, right? He'll be Evan.
We all want to celebrate and immortalize that performance. Yeah. Everybody, you know, because he's that special, and that character's that special. So, you know, all hands on deck. It's very, very exciting. And working with his father, Mark Platt, and the whole creative team, you know, Ben's Justin and Steven Levinson. So far, it's been a dream. Like, I don't know. Look, I love shows, and I love, there's something about the energy of people that are putting together a show and understand what that is, and it's very inspiring to be in that room.
When you think about that project, and then you also think about writing, that is exciting for you to know that you can do both, right? That you have one that you can work on at one time, and then when you get a pause, you can work on the other.
It is very exciting, but it's also, for me, what I've found over the years, it helps me greatly with artistic balance. If all I did was write novels, it would be too lonely a life for me. I'm a very social person. I really love being around people. And so just being alone in a room with my thoughts, it gets to be a little bit trying at times. I don't know how certain authors do it time after time after time. It's remarkable. But then I also feel that the greatest challenge artistically is the blank page. It's writing the next story from scratch. That is, you know, it's such a challenge. So that one keeps the directing honest, and the directing keeps me from being, like, you know, not, you know, too terribly isolated, you know, because I always want to remember that ultimately art should connect us to each other, not separate us.
Stephen Chbosky's new novel is Imaginary Friend. It is published by Grand Central. Stephen, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for joining us. What a great pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, Joe. It was great.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.